Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to the National and International Roundtable. I am your host, Mickey Hall. This show is presented by the Multi-Ethnic Sports Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame was founded by Arif Khatib in 2000 to give the world an opportunity to better understand the impact African Americans made in professional sports and in society. We presented induction ceremonies in New York, Seattle, Puerto Rico, Los Angeles, Ethiopia, Nairobi, Kenya, Virgin Islands, Houston, Atlantic City, Philadelphia, Oakland Bay Area, Las Vegas, Palm Springs, and Halifax, Nova Scotia. Please check out our website at www.afrosportshall.com to find out all the latest events that are coming up. So now, let me see if my partner in crime is around, Mr. Jesse Brooks. Sir,
hi,
check
Mickey.
In. How are
yes.
you, Mr. Traveling Man?
I know I'm good. You know, I'm in Washington, but I'm still glad that I can be with our listeners still and be with you. How are you?
I'm fine. I cannot complain. What are you doing back in Washington?
Well, you know, I'm an activist, and I'm involved in the medical field, especially around HIV. And so I also work with UCSF, researchers, scientists, as a community advisor. And so I'm out here with an advisory group called CFAR, Center for AIDS Research, that meet yearly. And we're meeting here in Washington, D.C. I'm in DuPont Circle, which is right down Embassy Row, so all the embassies are down this street. It's really beautiful. The weather is kind of cool compared to California, but I'm really having a good time. The conference was amazing. I'm really fired up to meet other advocates, to get best ideals, mm-hmm. and to know that we are making progress against HIV and you know, it's really been an awesome time. And you're right, I do travel a lot. But again, I get to meet great people. And so, I can't wait to tell you and get back home and tell you all about it. But I'm glad to be with you.
I'm so appreciative of you being with us. Me, you know what? It's just been busy as everything. You know, it seems like since you and I have been doing this show every single week, I got to say how heavy our hearts have been. Now it's with the horrible accident that happened
right.
in, you know, my birthplace, New York, you know.
Right.
And it's just so heartbreaking. You know, our hearts go out to everyone who this tragedy has affected, you know.
Right.
So
well, it does affect everyone.
It does. You know, the people injured, I guess, were tourists. It's just absolute horrible the way this hatred has prevailed in our
right.
country. But you know, New Yorkers, we loud, we proud, you know, and they took to the streets last night and continued. They had their Halloween parade, which did my heart good to see that, you know.
Right.
So as we say, love trumps hate. So
yeah.
you know But, you know, I guess tonight, man, everyone else is anxious and excited for the World Series.
I know. Amazing as well. So who do you think on sweeping?
You know, since none of my teams, you know, the A's or Boston are in it, you know, I got to throw my hat with Houston.
Okay.
But both teams have done just an outstanding job. You know, this is the most home runs in any World Series.
Right. You know, well, I was born in L.A., so you know who I'm with.
I know.
I got to go.
I know you go.
I got to go with my
daughter. Yeah. So I'll tell you what, winner takes the other one out for a nice lunch.
That'll be awesome. I can't wait to take me out.
All right, we'll see about that. You know where my favorite place is.
Okay.
So
right.
I I'm so excited about our guest today.
Me too.
Like I said, we have brothers that are representing today. And without further ado, let me introduce our listeners to them and we can get this show on the road, because I know they're just going to blow our listeners away. So let's get started here. Let's see. The first one, Brother Malik Wade, was born and raised in the low-income housing in San Francisco during the 80s, at the peak of the crack cocaine epidemic that swept through America's inner cities. Malik was a good student and a superior athlete, but his life would change forever when he sold his first rock of crack cocaine at the age of 15. Over the next two decades, Malik would experience a turbulent yet amazing personal transformation. That's going to be, he has an incredible, incredible story. Our second guest is he's just an awesome communications director here in the Bay Area. Richard Kevin Cartwright has been a communications, marketing, and media mongrel since 1994. Richard's focus and creative approaches to media relations and engagement has resulted in high volumes of coverage for clients in publications such as the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, San Francisco Business Times, CNET, Computer World, and just a dozen others. Recently, Richard has been named as the Program and Communications Director for KPFA in Berkeley, California. Both of these gentlemen are here with us today, and we are so honored to welcome Kevin Cartwright and Malik Wade. Brothers, welcome to the show.
Yeah,
thank
welcome.
You so much for having us.
I appreciate you having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So I'm going to just go ahead and start it off. And so first I want to know, Kevin or Richard, which name do you want to go by? Which name do you
just call
by?
Me Kevin. Just call me Kevin.
Okay, Kevin.
That's fine. Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Great. So, Kevin, we know that Malik was born in San Francisco. Where were you born? And give me a little bit about your – you were born in Oakland.
I was born in Oakland. I was born in Oakland in the 60s. And to be specific, I think you have to be specific when you talk about Oakland, but I was born in West Oakland.
Right.
And obviously for people who are from this area, you know that – traditional black neighborhood, black community. And I was born in the 60s, which was, you know, a very fertile, very, very interesting political, social time to be alive, because it's so funny. And I'm really, really happy to be on with Malik because, you know, as Mickey was reading his bio, it was really interesting. I was thinking about, you know, growing up in Oakland at that time and mm-hmm. really kind of recognizing the points in which things began to change, and how the struggle itself, just in terms of how it had formed and solidified in the 60s and how it had transformed, at least by the late 1970s into the early 80s. So it's just really interesting then to kind of just reflect about that. But, yeah.
It is, because you both were kind of in different generations in the Bay mm-hmm. Area. And I'm glad you
exactly.
brought up, you know, those times for you. We're talking about the Black Panthers. We're talking about free cheese and all that. Do you remember all that?
Not only do I remember all that, yeah, I absolutely remember all that, because the thing is that I think it's really interesting now, because, you know, it's we just celebrated a 50th anniversary, and there was a lot of just a lot of conversations being generated about what had actually occurred. There was a long-running exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and for a lot of folks who weren't familiar, they got a chance to see some kind of representation of what that time was like. But to be alive during that time and to be on the street, to be in and around West Oakland, it was amazing. And I do not use that word lightly. It was amazing. It was almost like, in a way, Black people looked at that time. It was just so phenomenal.
Yeah.
And it was omnipresent. It just felt like it was everywhere, that we were being impacted by a movement that we were still trying to articulate, still trying to understand. So it was really normal to go to Defermery Park or different parts of Oakland to go to rallies or to see Black Panthers on the streets or have them come to your class or, like, be able to go up and talk to them about what was going on. And also it was common to have a lot of political literature information everywhere. So you would, like, find out about what was the next meeting, the next struggle, the next move. I mean, it was just omnipresent. And so I just feel like it was, I mean, obviously it's really different now, but then it was just really, it was in the air. And it was just, and you knew who you were talking about, or you knew about George Jackson. Right. You knew.
Right.
I mean, it was just like you knew about Huey Newton. You knew about Bobby Seale.
Right.
And it wasn't it didn't feel like it was history. It felt like it was present. Right. And it also was like a really interesting time to be politicized, even as like a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old. You know, we would read newspapers every day about what they were doing and the impact they were having in our community and beyond. So it was just, it just felt like it was common knowledge back then.
Wow.
You know what? I'm grateful for that period, too. And you just took me back, man, to so many memories. And like you said, amazing memories that I was actually there. So thank you for that. But I want to go to Malik. And Malik, I know you were born in San Francisco. So tell me a little bit about your upbringing, and not give it too much about your book. We're going to get to that in a minute. But what part of San Francisco were you born in?
I was born in, my grandmother lived in a neighborhood called the Bayview Hunters Point neighborhood, which was a heavily African-American concentrated neighborhood at the time, although now it's been aggressively gentrified. But when I was growing up, it was a predominantly African-American neighborhood. My grandmother lived there, and I spent a lot of time there as a young man, but I actually grew up on the other side of town in a neighborhood called the Visitation, in an area called the Visitation Valley area, which consists of there were two huge public housing developments.
Right.
So I grew up in that area on the borderline of San Francisco in a city called Daly City. I grew up right, you know, across the street from San Francisco in Daly City.
Okay. And you say you were raised by your grandmother?
Actually, I was raised by my mother, but obviously, you know, Black children, we spent a lot of time at our grandmother's house, but I was actually raised by my mother.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Jesse. Now, you both of you brothers have different backgrounds. Your brother Kevin is a veteran from the Air Force. Malik, your career decision was an economic one. Tell how you got to make that decision and why you were making a decision at 15.
Well, when I was growing up, I grew up at the crescendo of the crack cocaine epidemic, which obviously ravaged every inner city in America, and San Francisco wasn't, you know, was no exception. So at the age of 15, San Francisco was flooded with crack cocaine. I was living at home. My mother was raising three children alone without any assistance or help from any of our fathers. And I was, a lot of people don't know, but I was 6'2" when I was 13 years old. And I'm 6'2" now, but I've never grown another inch. So I was a big kid, tall, and psychologically I believe that I was a hindrance to the household. I believe that I was, I thought that I was a liability. So I made the conscious decision to start selling drugs at the age of, at the age of 15, I started to sell crack cocaine.
Wow. And I mean, in the book, you credit two people kind of for shaping your, I guess, your thought process at the time. A James Moore was the first person that you say had very influential.
Yeah, no, there was a man. His name is James Hodges.
James Hodges, that's correct.
He was a guy in the community. He was will be considered a social activist. He was a very strong man, a very masculine man, a real smart guy, hard worker. He was, you know, he's about 6'2", 230 pounds, powerfully built, but he was a very intellectual man. And he took a liking to me when I was a young man. He started to mentor me. He started to give me nuggets of wisdom every time that he would see me. And that sort of shaped my personality to a certain extent. Even though I went in a different direction, I still had a good core of morals and values that were bestowed or that were given to me by Mr. Hodges.
Mickey, can I jump in here now? Because Malik, I'm really excited. You know, I don't want to go too much further without mentioning that you just wrote a book about your life, and it's called The Pressure from FBI Fugitive to Freedom.
Right.
So could you tell us a little bit about your book without giving it all away?
Well, the book pretty much encapsulates my life. It starts off with me, obviously, you know, starting to sell crack cocaine at the age of 15 as I made the transition from 15-year-old crack dealer to what the FBI considered me to be a nationwide drug dealer. By the time I was 19, I was selling drugs in Washington, D.C., New York, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And shortly thereafter, I was actually indicted by the FBI. They were seeking a life sentence in federal prison.
Wow.
I was, you know, I was very concerned for my freedom, so I left the United States, and I lived in exile for the next 7 years as a fugitive from the FBI. And ultimately, I was arrested, and when I was arrested, I immediately pled guilty to 15 years in federal prison.
Wow.
And so we'll get back to the book. I know it has a happy ending, so I want to talk about that too. So I'm going to turn it back over to my co-host, Mickey.
Thank you. Richard, tell everyone how you started with communications. Was it part of you being in the Air Force?
No, actually, I just kind of fell into it, but I did want to acknowledge Malik for a second because
one,
I'm really excited to I'm going to get his book, And yeah. I'm really excited to read his book. And the reason why is because, you know, I worked in Bayview Hunters Point. I also worked in Sunnydale for quite a bit in the early 2000s. And so I have a bit of understanding. I'm going to read his book because I know it's going to be incredibly pertinent, for particularly for younger people. But I know he had to go through struggle to be there. It is a difficult place. It can be difficult. So I know I just really look forward to reading his book. I'm sure it's going to really like clarify some things in my mind about like, what it was like to be there and have to make that life option, you know, to sell. But I would say for me, being in the Air Force came out of the same reality, which is, and we're talking about 1982, 1983, being from Oakland, being a non-white victim of racism, you don't have a lot of choices. And to me, even though, you know, I had an intellectual curiosity, I wasn't necessarily sure I was ready to go to college. So for me, the option was to, you know, really try to divert from what was happening to family members, have, you know, to friends that I had growing up, which was, you know, to really try to become part of the economy here and like to sell, you know, in order to survive, be able to provide for their families. So I decided to go to the Air Force. And I was a medic. So I worked at a big regional hospital. So, you know, so I didn't have any direct communicative things that kind of fell my way. I think I developed that after. I did pretty well while I was in the Air Force, and they let me leave early to go to college. So that was an opportunity that I had. And then it was from there that I got a chance to, you know, just to use my mind a little bit and to really start developing skills that, you know, I didn't have. So it was just, so communications didn't really come until much later after, you know, after I had started doing radio work. I started working at KPFA in the 90s as a producer and as a trainer. And that's when I really got a chance to start honing some of the craft and doing a lot more writing, you know, developing programs, things of that nature.
And I've seen you did some amazing things. Tell us about it, working with the New York Times, the Chronicle.
Right. Absolutely. So basically, you know, the thing is about communications right now, it's such a broad thing. There's no particular silos anymore where you can say, okay, this is radio, this is print media, this is television. Right. Everything's kind of exploded now. So you have a lot of hybridity. So you will have a combination of things that encompass communication. So like, again, like I work at a radio station, but all that means is that we have to be wary that we have to communicate along a number of different channels now. So that would be, yes, terrestrial radio, but also a number of social channels, be it Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, right, YouTube, or whatever. And you also have to have the ability to leverage any kind of writing that you're able to do, as well as try to throw in a layer of copywriting, right? And just be familiar with how much more precision goes with writing now, because it's not just kind of like free expository stuff. You have to be very, very, very specific and targeted. So a lot of it's changed from when I did it.
Yeah.
Like I did basically what you might consider like traditional public relations, and I did that for technology companies. So it's better about like really taking an idea that you have and really shaping it, shaping an idea and being able to pitch like reporters, like who are different publications,
right,
and really try to get them hooked on your idea so that you can resource them, so they can build out a story. So that's why I was able, I had a really good ability to take an idea and shape it and give it body, give it form, to be able to pitch it to like a reporter so that they can take it and build it out for their editorial audiences. So that's why, you know, I was able to like work with the New York Times and a ton of publications, be it like tech publications or business publications or or dailies or whatever, television. So I just had a knack for doing that. But it really, you know, I think at the core was just being able to read and process information and being able to transpose it to, like, writing. So writing, reading, the most fundamental things that you can do in any communications work, reading and writing. That's it, seriously.
How did you get into the business? I mean, did you always write? Were you always a writer, always a reader?
Yeah, I was definitely always a reader, and I did some writing. Like, I do writing now. Like, I write plays. I mostly write plays and write some short stories and things like that. But it was just, to me, it was just like an intellectual curiosity that I had. I mean, when I was in the Air Force, I was 19 years old, and when you're a medic, you work really long hours, and it's hard, it's difficult, it's emotionally exhausting. Yeah, I was working with folks who were basically a lot of cancer patients, and so it's incredibly taxing. And so you just try to find some kind of relief, you know. And I know a lot of my peers, you know, they chose to, like, use substances in the Air Force. I tried to direct myself towards learning and just really focusing on what is it that I can learn, because I just wanted to get out. You know, I really ultimately, like, had a plan to, like, I want to do something else. One of the things I really wanted to do was go to college. So I really invested, you know. So instead of, like, going to the bar, like, I went to the library, right? Instead of, like, just hanging out, I went into, like, San Francisco and went to museums. I mean, I just wanted to learn. And I just wanted to feel like I was growing in a very kind of compressed experience, being that in the military. So that's how I got, I thought, like, it was important for me just to think and to challenge myself first and foremost, because that's what you're constantly doing when you're doing communications. It's like, you're really honestly, you are processing information, right? And you're transposing information that is digestible for audiences that you're trying to make meaning for and with, right? So first, even before you're writing, you're really honestly thinking and processing. And so whether that's, like, you're writing on the page, whether you're broadcasting, whether you're, like, sharing a hashtag, whether you're creating, like, a value proposition, right, whatever it is, it's the brain work that comes first, right? And it has to be rigorous. Right. And so that's what I found to be kind of one of the unsaid things when we're talking about communications. It's like, even before you do anything, it's just really putting your brain through the rigor so that you're able to process information.
Right. Thank you.
Brother Malik, your book,
yes, ma'am.
For our readers, I'm like nosing the book. This is such a wonderful, wonderful read. Pressure, and I got mines right here at Marcus Books, who, by the way, in a minute, I want you to tell the listeners you're doing a book reading over there, but talk about that in a minute. But how did you manage to get the public defender, Jeff Hadachi, to write the foreword for this incredible book?
Well, Jeff is he's a great man. He is I believe he's a true champion for justice, and he's a true champion for doing the right thing. So I was able to engage him a couple of years ago at an event. We had a conversation. I came to his office, and we had a conversation, and I felt that he was genuine and sincere in terms of being a voice for the voiceless and being an advocate for people who live in downtrodden and oppressed communities. So we continued our dialogue, and I told him that I would be writing the book, that I wanted him to be a part of the project. He agreed, and he signed on, and he kept his word, and he wrote the foreword for the book. And I'm grateful for him. I'm grateful that he did that, that he kept his word.
Wow. Go on, Jess.
Yeah, so I wanted to go into, since we're talking about Oakland, since we're talking about activism, I really got excited because that's what I do. Would you tell people who your favorite author is and why?
My favorite author is Malcolm X.
Malik.
Well, go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Well, obviously, my favorite book is the autobiography of Malcolm X. I believe that that is a magnum opus that every black man, African, any African throughout the diaspora, I believe that they should start there. That's my favorite book, and that's my, you know, even though he supposedly Alex Haley wrote the book, the autobiography of Malcolm X is my favorite book.
Wow. How about you, Kevin? Do you have any mentors that you kind of contribute your path to?
Wow, that's a great question. I definitely appreciate it. I definitely concur with Malik on the Malcolm X. I think it's a really, I think when I first read it, it was just, it took me a minute to just be like, wow, just, you know, really just grasping the magnitude of that. But I would say this, in recent years, I think there's a few books that kind of stick out for me, which I think are critical, about five or six, which I'll name. I would say first for me, The ISIS Papers by Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. I think it is one of the most important and perceptive books that I've probably ever read in my life, because of pieces that she wrote in 1976, 77, 8, 9, 1980, 81, 82 are right on the money. And her analysis is it's a phenomenal book. So I and it's incredibly accurate and helpful to me. I would also say Yorugu, which is by Dr. Marimba Ani, is, again, Malik mentioned magnus opus. I would say that is indeed a magnus opus. Yorugu, I would say Mr. Neely Fuller's book is a must-read, an absolute must-read. I would say Medical Apartheid by Harry A. Washington. That's also kind of in the top level books that I think everyone should, every black person should read Medical Apartheid. The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson. And there's so many more. Dr. Bobby E. Wright's Slender Volume, which was magnificent. There's so many, but those are the ones that kind of come to mind right now, which have been very, very important for me to understand the system and culture that we live in, and to encourage me to think about how to best use my time. And really thinking seriously about solving this problem of racism and white supremacy. Like, I think those are the books that come to mind that I think are most helpful to me currently.
I totally got to get that list from you. Wow.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
May I share five must-reads?
Please.
The majority of the books. There are certain authors that I believe all black folks should read. I believe all black folks should read anything by Cheikh Diop.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that black folks should read anything by Frantz Fanon. They should also read The ISIS Papers by Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. And they should read anything by John Henry Clark, Anthony Crowder, or Dr. Ben Yakinen.
Mm-hmm.
I think those will give most folks a really, really good, some really good underpinnings. I believe that everyone should read The Miseducation of the Negro by Carter G. Woodson. And of course, I can go on and on, but, you know,
that's
some books that would,
for me.
Yeah, that'll give a person a really good foundation.
Mm-hmm. I concur.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Malik, you had another book that was one of your favorites by Sun Tzu's The Art of War, which I think,
Sun Tzu.
I did it for business in college. And you did it for life on the street experience. is such a contrast with the books that we mentioned, but they are. I mean, each of you brothers just mentioned some some history here.
Right.
This is, as in terms of contrast, that's interesting that you would say that, because I believe as a black man, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, I have to know who I am and who we are.
Yeah,
so
right.
You know, I read the Egyptian Book of the Dead. I read the Metuneter by Raoul Neferamin. I read a lot of books about us, African history, African-American history. But I also believe that it is very important to study European history. I believe that it is important to study European philosophers. You have to read Chomsky. You have to read Nietzsche. You have to read Kierkegaard, Kant, Descartes. You have to read Leibniz. You have to read Spinoza, Alexander Pushkin. You have to read, you have to have a wide, you have to have a very diverse reading, a very diverse reading palette. You have to read Dostoevsky, the Prince by Machiavelli. You have to read all of those different things. And then you also have to read other things. You have to read things about political science and economics and,
It
goes on and on.
Exactly. But let me pose this question to each of you, and Jesse, you can weigh in afterwards, because everyone's experiences are different. But as men, but specifically as black men, how do you motivate yourselves every day to stay positive in these trying times? Let's start with Brother Kevin.
That's a great question. I think that for me it's pretty simple. I have my offspring is like 9 years old. He's motivation enough. I see. And in black people, I see possibility, even though we are constantly being fed and programmed and conditioned to believe that we're not, that us, you know, solving this problem, I'll put it that way, solving this problem on this planet is near impossible. I see possibility, and I think just when we first started talking about where we were from, I got a hint of possibility. I saw what possibility looked like, and it wasn't through cinema. It wasn't through some short story. Like, I saw it every day growing up in Oakland. I saw it in West Oakland. I saw black people really, really exerting point of view, power, position, and challenging, which had been at that point already centuries old racism, white supremacy, and not blinking. So the thing is that just told me very, very early on that we can solve this problem. So I take that every day and just say, look, like, I have to be very mindful about how I use my time, what I am thinking about, and what I'm choosing to do as a result of thinking through this problem. And so the thing is like, I try to make things solution foundational. Mm-hmm. And I call it solution foundational and say, like, I get up trying to think through this problem and coming up with solutions. So that's why I do. And I'm like, and I, again, just again, hearing about Malik and his book, that's very exciting to me. That's very exciting to me. Cause I'm like, here's a brother who's like, to me in his own way, saying we can solve this problem.
Right.
We can solve this problem, you know, and so that's enough for me. That's enough material evidence that I can use and be like, I'm empowered by that. I'm empowered by the fact that he wrote his book. You know what I mean? So that's all I need. I don't need a lot, but that's all I need. Yeah.
You're amazing, man.
Wow, you're amazing, Kevin. Brother Malik, what about you? What keeps your motivation going?
It's simple. I mean, it's very easy. Over 700 black men murdered in the city of Chicago last year.
Come on now, brother.
It's, you know, and over 700 young black men murdered in the city of Chicago. If that doesn't motivate you, you shouldn't get up. You don't deserve to wake up. If you can't get motivated by that, you don't deserve to wake up.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. I know. I feel like we have the talk of the bridges here. We got San Francisco represented, and we got Oakland representing, history from Bayview Pointer, history from West Oakland. Jesse, you're native Oaklander too. You know, I mean, I'm the outsider here. You guys are just full of this education, and I want to get back to it in 1 minute. We're coming up. We're past our half hour. Let me make two announcements. Jesse, you have any announcements this week, hon?
I don't.
Okay, I just have two quick ones to make. I want to let our viewers and listeners know. This Friday, Oakland's First Friday that's on Telegraph is already canceled due to the inclement weather. So they're getting the word out early now. So First Friday, the outside activity is canceled. All right. Yeah. So, and this was going to be my first visit back since I left them. But I'll wait till next month. And
I'll
also,
go with you.
All right, bet. That'll be great. Also, I know Californians are buckling down for that big gas tax we're getting hit with. So don't forget, 12 cents per gallon for regular unleaded and 20 cents if you've got those diesels. So brace for that, but that was approved last time? So the voters approved it, so now we got to buckle down and do that. But that's it for the announcements. Let's get back to these brothers. Jesse, you have the next question, sir.
Well, I wanted to throw my hat in about motivation, because I believe that I was born for such a day as this, to motivate. And so the way I stay motivated for me is to motivate others. And I try to live my life as an attraction where I don't have to tell people this is what you do. People can look at my life and want to be happy and be free and fight for our rights. So that's my motivation, is to be an attraction to uplift other people, and that means my family, my community, and that's what it's all about. But I wanted to go to you, Malik, because the other thing, as I hear you talk, as I hear you talk about writing the book, but today, you have done so much from where you come from, and I also know that negativity sometimes can be a motivation. And for you today to be an author, an entrepreneur, to be a mentor to young people is amazing. And I read that you said it took like 15 years to change. I've gone through challenges in my life, so I can understand that. So kind of tell me, what do you mean by the changes that you went through in those 15 years to become the amazing man you are today?
I mean, like they say, change is it's not an event, it's a process. So obviously being sentenced to 169 months is 14 years and 1 month in federal prison.
Right.
That is motivation in itself for you to change. And it was a cumulative process that happened as a result of steadfast prayer and meditude, the ancestors at 4:30 in the morning, speaking to Marcus, speaking to Malcolm, speaking to Steve Biko, Patricia Lumumba, and Fannie Lou Hamer, and Harriet Tubman, and some others, conditioning my mind, trying to strengthen my intellect, trying to strengthen my body and trying to strengthen my emotional core. So there wasn't just one specific road to Damascus moment. It was a series of moments, series of epiphanies that took place over time, predominantly while I was in prison. Obviously, when you're in prison, you have a lot of time to be introspective and to look deep inside of yourself. And you know, I'm not necessarily satisfied at the outcome. I believe that the biggest room in the house is the room, you know, for growth. So I'm still evolving. I'm still changing. I'm still today. I'm still every morning. I am still speaking with the ancestors, whether it be Imhotep or Akhenaten or Nzinga. I'm still having those conversations every day in an attempt to evolve, in an attempt to change. So by no stretch of the imagination, am I done evolving or am I done shifting my paradigm?
And that's motivation in itself, and I hope that we have brothers that think that they can't change listening to you, because you are a perfect example of someone that can change their life and start being a productive member of our community, which we need our strong black men in our community. So I want, actually, Malik, I want to give you time now to talk about your upcoming book launch and also how people can buy your book.
I'm glad you give me that opportunity. The book, I'll be doing a book signing at Marcus Books December 10th. I just came back from a month-long book in Philadelphia. I was in New York, Harlem, New York, Philadelphia, New Jersey, Atlanta, and Detroit. So now I am, I'll be doing a book signing December 10th at Marcus Books. And I will be doing another book signing in Atlanta in December. So just trying to get the word out, trying to promote not only the book, but promote my nonprofit organization as well. The name of the nonprofit is SIG, which stands for Scholastic Interest Group, which is a mentoring program where I have 15 young men in the Bayview Hunters Point community that I mentor. Over the last couple of years, I've taken 15 young men on an all-expenses-paid college tour. This past April, I connected with another nonprofit organization called Operation Genesis, and we chaperoned 14 young folks to Accra, Ghana. So those are things that I'm involved with at this time. All of those things pretty much are detailed in the book about why I got involved, why I felt that I had a spiritual, sacred and ancestral duty to get involved in the community. I believe that, you know, we're in a state of emergency. Obviously, we need all hands on deck. We can't afford for individuals to be on the sidelines, not being active, engaged, and involved.
What about a website,
so, the book,
social media? How do people contact you?
The book is available on my website, MalikWade.com. That's MalikWade.com. Facebook is under my name, Malik Wade. Instagram is Malik, MalikWade, underscore SIG. So I'm pretty good with returning emails, prompt and very punctual with returning emails, phone calls. Obviously, I'm available. I do a lot of speaking at juvenile halls and high schools, and I just spoke at Boak Law School last week. I just was at Stanford. I was in a special program at Stanford Law School in 2013, so I just went there last week as well. So
I'm
available.
I predict that you're going to need an assistant soon, so you can return the emails that you're going to get. You know, I really do. So, Kevin, how does it feel to be working at KPFA to get the position that you just got as a cultural, to be on a historic radio station?
That's a very big question, and probably it'll take too long to decode all of the things I could possibly say. I do acknowledge that it is historic. For people who don't know, it's like the first public radio station in the United States. It was established in 1949, even before most people had FM radios or signals. They were broadcasting on FM, so that's one interesting thing about it. I think it's complicated. You know, it's like it has a long, illustrious history, very challenging history with that challenging people who feel very passionate about the work that they do. For me, I really try to focus on actualizing what I'm thinking and how I can best create attributes, assets for the station so that more people have access to it. And that we make the respectful transition from just simply being a radio station to actually like a media entity, because of just by virtue of how people communicate now and where people are at in terms of like their engagement and their engagement level. So we're assuming that like it's the same that it was 30 years ago, where people are sitting by the radio or they're sitting by the couch listening to the radio, when in fact that's simply not true anymore. They're accessing it on phones and tablets, and they're in their cars. They're like, you know, they're leveraging podcasts, or they're engaging. They want to ask questions. They're not always at home at 6 o'clock, you know, for dinner anymore. Things have just completely exploded in that regard. And so one of the things that's exciting for me to be at KPFA is that I can help create that reality for folks that it doesn't seem intimidating or strange or bizarre, but that people really take on the challenge of like finding multiple ways to engage audiences who are really hungry, particularly now, they're really hungry for information, but accurate information, right? And so because it's really important, accuracy and clarity, super, super important right now. And there's not a lot of trusted sources that are delivering, right? And so we happen to be an entity that is doing the best they can to do it. And we're probably doing a lot better than a lot of folks are doing right now. So it's interesting right now for us and for a lot of places. And particularly for me, it's exciting because we can, and you know, the thing is, we have like this amazing archive of information. So let's say like the next book, like that someone was going to write, they really wanted to focus on June Jordan, for instance. We have so much information and speeches and interviews from June Jordan or Angela Davis or Bobby Seale or Huey. I mean, it's like incredible, but we never really leveraged it in the right way. So that's one of the things that I'm working on, is how we can make it more accessible for everyday people, so that they can use that information and perhaps apply it to some of their activism or their writing or their thinking or their sharing or whatever it is, really just trying to put it in the hands of folks that they can like use it. So it's really interesting and exciting time for us at KPFA.
How do people connect with KPFA?
Well, I would say, well, obviously the website, kpfa.org, or if they want to ask questions to me, Kevin@kpfa.org. Please feel free to email me. And I was going to even suggest from Malik, I don't know if he's ever connected with Kat Brooks out here, but Kat Brooks is a colleague and she's a co-host of a program called Upfront.
Good.
Have you heard back?
I did it about 2 months ago, and I don't know. I didn't hear anything back when they were supposed to air it. But I've already done the second.
Oh, he did the show.
Oh, you already did. All right, on, man. Because I hope he is connected with Kat, because she's all about that, man. She's all about that. So that's great. I'm really happy to hear it.
KPFA,
what's the
dial on the radio?
Oh, 94.1
FM.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. Yeah. Let me lighten the mood a little bit, and let's have some fun with this one, brothers. What's on your bucket list? What's on your bucket list of things you want to still experience?
I thought you said lighting. That's kind of
that is light. The bucket list. What's the fun things you want to do?
Okay, tell us. Come on, Kevin.
Oh, okay. Okay, so hopefully by next year I want to go to Senegal. It's definitely been something that I've just been really trying to work on right now. I want to go and just spend some time visiting and doing some writing and doing a lot of asking questions. Definitely it is exhausting being in the United States, being in this system. And we just, just be able to, like, have some distinctions from being here. So that's one thing in my bucket list that's important to me right now.
Good. What about you, Brother Malik?
I'm planning a trip to Egypt right now. I went to Accra, Ghana in April, so I am planning a trip next year to Egypt. I would like to.
So, Mickey, I take that back. That was an uplifting question.
Well, thank you, Brother Jesse. See, I told you that would be fun because, I tell you, Malik and I had the pleasure of meeting, about a month ago now, at the BE, the Black Enterprise Tech Connect. And it was the last day there, and I was heading out. And Brother Malik was standing on the side, and very politely he said, "Excuse me, sister, but can I ask you a question?" And I walked over, and he posed the question, "How do you like the conference?" So we started talking, and when I asked Malik how did he hear about it and he started telling me about himself, I have just been impressed with this young brother that I just can't stop talking about him to everyone that I meet. His story is amazing. When you look at his picture, there is no way you could tell. And I wouldn't have guessed it only because the brother told me that he was on the FBI's most wanted list. Never in a million years. So if there is people out there listening, you don't know someone's story till you start to speak with them and listen. And Malik's book, people have to, you really do have to order it, get it, read it, share it with your children and share it with your sons and your daughters. It's a little bit of everyone. You know, Kevin, like you said, you just can't wait. I'm telling you, you will truly enjoy it.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to be there with my book to get my autograph on the 10th for sure.
Definitely.
I'd like to accentuate something about the book. I want to, basically let people know that it's a classic redemption story. It is not blood and guts. It is not, it's more of an intellectual. It's more intellectual insight into someone who lived in that lifestyle. Obviously, it talks about me being on the FBI's wanted list for 7 years, but a lot of people have written books in a similar vein, but they sort of deify themselves, and it's sort of a subliminal and subconscious way for them to make themselves relevant again. It's not that type of book. The book is being used as curriculum for high schools, for the public defender's office in San Francisco. It's a good book that I believe young men can get a lot of pertinent information out of because they can see how I transitioned from a young man, a 15-year-old crack dealer, who had been convicted on firearms charges on four separate occasions, someone who pled guilty to 15 years in federal prison, to someone now who runs a nonprofit organization who spends a lot of time in Silicon Valley, who is an asset to the community,
mm-hmm.
who works with young people.
Exactly.
Wow, what a show, Mickey.
I'm telling you, I know. Can you believe it? I can't believe it's already time to sign off. But before we do that, brothers, please tell the people once again, and Brother Kevin, let me start with you, how they can reach you, the radio show, what important events are coming up, and then Brother Malik, please. Give everyone the information. Kevin, let's start with you.
Sure. If people want to reach out, they can reach me at KPFA, of course, kevin@kpfa.org. Man, we're going to have a pretty big year. We're probably going to be doing some really kind of pulling out a lot of the archive stuff. We're going to be building a rather robust YouTube channel that's going to feature a lot of our archives, a lot of our like history long speaker series. So we're going to be making that available for folks in early 2018. So I'm really excited about that.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Wow.
Yeah.
And Malik, what about you? Let everyone know the book again, your website and your upcoming book signings.
The website again is Malik Malik Wade WADE.com. You can get the book from my website, or if you like, you can order the book on Amazon or Barnes and Noble's Kindle KDP. The book is available everywhere books are sold online. And you can also get it from my website. It's just my name, Malik Wade.
Wonderful.
Wow, thank you.
Ooh, Jesse, your final thoughts, please.
Well, my final thoughts is I'm walking away as we talk about motivation. I'm very motivated. You both brothers give me hope. And I'm really happy to meet both of you. And Malik, I can't wait for your book signing. And Kevin, wow, you're amazing, man. So thank you both for joining our show this week.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
How about you, Mickey? Any final words?
Well, I'm just totally words. I'm overwhelmed, gentlemen, because you two have definitely educated, informed, and inspired everyone. And me as a sister sitting here listening to your stories and the history, I am honored to have you on this show and to know you, gentlemen. So please, don't stop what you're doing. There's a lot more good things coming both your ways, and I know we're going to be hearing a lot more from both of you. So thank you again for taking time out of your day to spend with us. We are so grateful, and peace and love to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, everyone, we hit the 5 o'clock mark just so quickly today, and because that's how much of a wonderful show this was. So I just want to again thank the brothers Kevin Cartwright from KPFA in Berkeley and author, writer, educator, fugitive, Brother Malik Wade. Both of these brothers have a story to tell, and we hope that we have shared some of what they have lived in this wonderful world of ours. So I want to thank everyone again for tuning in to another wonderful show. Hope you'll come back next week for another great show. Don't forget, this show is archived 1 hour after this broadcast, so you can listen at your leisure. And again, I want to say thank you again to our guests. Jesse, thank you so much for your traveling and calling in and being with us. Arena, Judge Wilson, Denise, thank you all for just your support, your continued support. To everyone, have a great week. Stay blessed. Stay safe. Goodbye.